So today I'm going to take up a koan out of Mumankan, and it's the ninth koan early in this book of 48 stories, each of which are unique, you might say, dimensions of our practice and awakening, and what's important in our Zen endeavor. And this is number 9, and the title of it is Daitsu Chiso. But before I go into it, I want to just go back to something to kind of set the stage for this koan that I said last night at dinner. I talked about what Sesshin is, what Zazen is. If you were to say one thing to someone who had never heard of Sesshin before, to describe what it is that you do here, it's that you're going in a unique direction. Now, ordinarily in everyday life, human beings, and that includes everybody in this room, is contending in an outward direction, outward. The world surrounding you, circumstances in your life, people that you have to meet, tasks you have to complete, concerns on your mind, achievements, comparisons, all of it. We know all of this very, very well. And it's not to put it down, it's our human life. And we need to do it in order to survive. It's very, very important. And in the completion of this outward activity, it's necessary for us to create ideas, have memories. We develop what is called concepts, which are mental formations to substitute for an actual reality as a kind of shortcut, a way of standardizing things. We attempt to make things better and better. We get more and more education, more and more degrees, make more and more money if we can, have a better and better job if we can, more and more friends if we can, build bigger and taller buildings, more powerful and deadly armies. All of these things are going on in this outward direction. Now, something in the movement in this direction, for perhaps everyone, but certainly for everyone in this room, leaves you feeling that there is a profound something missing. An itch that isn't getting scratched. A deep need that isn't being satisfied. Even when everything is going great, even when all the achievements are happening, things seem to be going your way. I remember many times in my life everything seemed great and I would have this little cold wind blow through my head. Watch it, Paul, the worm is about to turn. And it usually does. So, you know, there's a beautiful description of this in a movie. I've talked about this before. The movie was this Woody Allen movie, Stardust Memories, and I'm going to go through a little bit of what this scene shows. It was early in the movie, but I'm going to go all the way through to the end of the scene, which sometimes people miss because the middle of it is so funny, and basically Woody Allen is sitting on a train, and the train pulls into a station, and the camera pans around the train, a la Ingmar Bergman or Alfred Hitchcock, just momentarily resting its lens on each face. And each face has this just dour expression, pale, pasty, sad, downturned mouth, isolated, alienated, despairing. You know, the human condition. And Woody Allen is there too, you know, his ruffled head, his glasses, his awkward appearance, sitting there, crouching in his seat, looking around furtively. And now, into the station next to this train in the opposite direction, pulls in another train. And he's looking at this train, and he looks through the window of his train and through the window of the other train, and in this other train are people having this wild party. Beautiful women, beautiful men, champagne bottles popping, people laughing, people embracing, people kissing, just wonderful. And then Woody Allen's train starts to pull away from the station. And this is the scene that just is so precious and so funny. He puts his hands on the window and starts slapping at the window, trying to get out of the train. He's banging at the window as the train is pulling out, and you're seeing these people parting, and he's looking around at these dour people that are actually ignoring him. They're so isolated and alienated, they don't even see him going through all of these machinations. And he gets more desperate as the train starts to pull out, and it's a long train, and he starts pulling at the suitcase and ripping at the door and trying to lift the window, and everything fails. So that's the scene. But it doesn't end there. So then the next scene, it cuts to a whole new scene, and you see all the people on Woody Allen's train, including Woody Allen, all the dour people, the young girl with a very large nose, the depressed-looking guy who's bald, the overweight person with a cigarette stain on his mustache, and all the rest of it, walking in a line, filing past this giant steaming garbage heap with seagulls flying around. And then in the distance you see something, some other group of people coming at him, at this line of people on his sat train. So as he gets closer and closer, you begin to notice the camera starts to focus on these people at the far side of the steaming garbage heap. And they're all the people that were on the happy train. They're coming to the same garbage heap. And that's the scene. So, what is the message here? This is a wonderful message. I guess it would start kind of with the Four Noble Truths. That when you seek outside, maybe what you'll find is something really wonderful. It matches your expectations temporarily. Achieves what you wanted in that moment. And perhaps you'll be frustrated. Perhaps something painful will happen. Perhaps you'll get your heart broken. Perhaps you'll get sick. But eventually all these things fall apart. You know, the first noble truth, life is dukkha, life is unsatisfactoriness, incompleteness. So some of us were fortunate enough and had the internal drive, perhaps, the karma, whatever you want to call it, to trip over a practice that takes you in a completely different direction. It's not about, or it shouldn't be, about getting on one train versus another train and going somewhere outward. This is the inward direction. This is pointing the light of the mind in on itself. It's not easy to do. It's difficult. We have to learn various techniques to do it. And there are all sorts of ways in which the old pattern of looking outward infiltrates, contaminates this process. It's very clear in Buddhism how it's happened, because Buddhism really is a human endeavor like any other human endeavor. And you have more and more wonderful Buddha realms populated by one Buddha more spectacular than the next Buddha. Sitting on clouds with rainbows and all the iconography, which, you know, has a certain purpose in order to stimulate faith and point the seeker in a direction of something other than, you know, worldly gain, but often creates ideas and comparisons. I'll never get there. I don't have what it takes. I'm not a Buddha like that. Then another form it takes is seeking teachers. One teacher isn't good enough. Oh, I got a more enlightened teacher. Oh, that teacher had problems. They had they were neurotic, or they had difficulties, or they did this and that, so they're not right, you know. And now I have the perfect teacher. Until you really get to know that teacher and realize that there's a certain human side to that teacher. So you can see how this outward movement can contaminate a process, the key to which is an inward movement. So we need to learn this inward movement. So one of the ways we do this is we look at the very most outward aspect of this outward movement, the very most outward aspect of the outward way of moving, which is not unimportant but doesn't help us here, is conceptual thinking, is making a model of something, an idea in our mind. And the most dangerous ideas here are ideas about Buddhism and ideas about a self inside, a separated entity with characteristics, all those ideas. And those ideas trap us. We get stuck there. We start to compare ourselves. We start to have an idea of how we ought to be, but how we're not. So this practice, maybe I'm not right for this practice. Maybe this practice isn't right for me. Maybe I failed. Maybe I'll never get there. All of these thoughts that arise from conceptual thinking, from getting caught in this very outward realm. Now, what is Zazen exactly? How does it begin to deal with this? Zazen looks directly at the actual experience of each moment. The actual experience. In a sense, it's, as I've put it before and as it's put in quantum physics, it takes this cloud of probability, which is the conceptual thinking world, the world of planning, ideas, hopeful, you know, the future, things we want to achieve, and it collapses it down to this actual experience. This moment-by-moment sensation. Sensation. It goes from concept to sensation. This is the very first step. This is the critical turn. This is what we all must do if we want to learn to move in this direction. We have to go from concept, idea, comparison, picture, an idea of perfection, into an actual experience of something, and I'll use the word real, real. You hear this word a lot in Buddhism, real, reality. What is reality? What does this word mean? We must deeply look into these words that on the concept level are fuzzy, but when we really peer into them, what is real? Real is what appears, what actually is, what is. So in this process, we're going from what we think, what we conceive of, what we imagine, what we project, to what we actually are experiencing moment by moment, what you would call sensation, what is so-called real, real, actual, the breath, the count, the feeling of your legs folded, your hands in a mudra, the koan you're working with, the flow of the present moment, then in and out of the breath, whatever it is, whatever your practice is at that moment. And if a pain comes in, then it's the pain. Now, what if a conceptual thought comes in? What do you do then? This is the difficulty here, is how thought traps us. What do you do then? The thought, as I've said many times, is a sensation. It has reality. The thought is actually an expression of what one might call true nature. In other words, it appears. It has a form to it. It's the sensation of thinking, not its meaning. its meaning is on that outward level, conceptual thinking, delusion, ideas, planning, strategizing. But all of that is sense. You know when you're thinking. You sense thinking. The brain, the sensory organ of thought, senses thought. That's where we start. Ah, this is the sensation of this thought. We don't do battle with the thought. Now we look directly at the sensation. And we notice that as a sensation, it is real. It's real. Not as an idea, as a sensation. What do I mean as a sensation of thought is real? A thought presents. A thought is. Now, when I say is, I mean in our center. It can't be if it isn't in our center. So the thought is in your center. The sound is in your center. The breath is in your center. The breeze from the fan is in your center. This is how we start to move in this direction. Very, very important. Now I'm going to read something from the Diamond Sutra again as a preparation for this particular koan. Let's just say a word about the Diamond Sutra. And once again, this process is about, and sesshin literally means sesshin, collecting the mind. Shin is mind. Sess in Japanese means to collect. So we're actually pulling the mind back from its excursion outward into grasping at things with conceptual thinking, to sensation, pulling it in to the presentation, the reality. And then the fact that reality, meaning something is, means it is in my center. It can't be anywhere else. And then entering that. So this whole process of going from outside to inside, from the appearance of things, the shell, the ideas in my mind, to the very core of what you might call Buddha nature. So let me read this from the Diamond Sutra. This is section 26. It's a number of sections. They're all very, very short in this sutra. This sutra, incidentally, is one of the core sutras for Zen Buddhism. You have the Diamond Sutra, you have the Lankavatara Sutra, you have the Heart Sutra. The Diamond Sutra is probably the most beloved, most profound of all the sutras upon which many of the Zen koan and Zen teachings are founded. So I'm going to read this, and the title of this section is "The Body of Truth Has No Marks." And Subhuti is the monk, a very advanced senior monk of the Buddha. And he is the foil in the Diamond Sutra. And the Buddha will ask Subhuti questions and Subhuti will answer. Almost always, in almost every section, when Subhuti answers, he answers appropriately. And the Buddha said, "Very good, Subhuti." This particular situation is a little different, which is interesting. Maybe we'll talk about that. So he says, "Subhuti, what do you think? May the Tathagata be perceived by the 32 marks," and then in parentheses, "of a great man." So it's said in Buddhism that you can tell a Buddha because they have 32 marks. The marks include physical appearance and a certain manner of deportment and a certain way of behavior and, you know, on and on. So if you were looking for a teacher, you'd try to find as many of these marks as possible, right? To make sure they're as close to the Buddha as possible. So, what do you think? May the Tathagata be perceived by the 32 marks of a great man? Of course, Subhuti answers, "Yes, certainly, the Tathagata may be perceived thereby." Then Buddha said, "Subhuti, if the Tathagata may be perceived by such marks, any great imperial ruler is the same as the Tathagata." Remember that happy train now and where it ended up. Subhuti then said to the Buddha, "World Honor One, as I understand the meaning of Buddha's words, the Tathagata may not be perceived by the 32 marks." See how we've made our turn here. starting to move in a new direction. Whereupon the world-honored one uttered this verse, "He who sees me by form, he who seeks me in sound, perverted are his footsteps upon the way, for he cannot perceive the Tathagata." If we have an idea of a particular form, if we're looking for a particular sound to the voice, a particular manner, that's what I need to be to get enlightenment. That's what I need to find the right teacher, whatever it might be. Whatever model we have of reality that must be matched in order for us to find what it is we're looking for here, then perverted are his footsteps upon the way, for he cannot perceive the Tathagata. Now let's go into this one word, the Tathagata. What does this mean? What's the meaning of this whole thing? It is quite puzzling, isn't it? The Diamond Sutra is a giant koan, really, or a series of koan. Tathagata is one of the many appellations of the Buddha, and its specific meaning is one who has gone thus. One who has gone thus. There's a word used in Buddhism, particularly in Zen, thus or thusness. Sometimes it's put such or suchness. Thus. A Buddha is one who has gone thus. Now it's easy to mistake what this word means. Thus, oh, you mean thus towards the 32 marks? Or thus towards a spectacular awakening experience? Is that what we mean by thus? On thus. Thus. When you hear a sound, what is the thusness of the sound? When you feel the air being blown by the fan on the ceiling here on your skin, what is the thusness of that sensation? The Tathagata is one who has gone thus. As it is. As it presents. Is. Appears. This is what brings you to the center. Not matching some external form. It's subtle but critically important. Now let's pick up this koan, this beautiful koan. What a wonderful koan. I've gone through these various times during my practice career, so to speak. And it amazes me, some of these koan, when I look at them again, I realize how important they are, how profound they are. The first time around, the second time around, I didn't get it quite like that. So I'm going to read this koan. The title of it is Daitsu Chisho. And I'll just define the word Daitsu Chisho. These are Japanese words. Dai is great, tsu is penetration. Chi is wisdom, and sho is profound. So this is the Buddha, Daitsu Chisho was a Buddha. He was one of the many, many Buddhas. There have been countless Buddhas throughout the ages. He's one of the ancient Buddhas. And he is the Buddha of great penetration and unsurpassed wisdom. And here's the case. A monk asked Seijo, who was a Zen master of Koyo, that was a town. Monk asked Seijo of Koyo, "Daitsu Chisho Buddha did zazen for 10 kalpas in a meditation hall and could neither manifest the truth nor attain Buddhahood." That's how the legend goes, I guess. Why was this? Seijo said, "Your question is a very appropriate one." The monk persisted. Why did he not attain Buddhahood by doing zazen in the meditation hall? Seijo replied, because he didn't. How puzzling. What is being pointed at here? Now remember what I said about this process, coming from concepts which would be like the outer edges of the universe that we're going to the center of here, into sensations, actualities, reality, into the fact that these things appear, and that appearance can only happen in my center, and then entering the center. This progression. The monk said, Daitsu Chisho Buddha, this Buddha of great penetration, did zazen for 10 kalpas. A kalpa is an incalculable period of time. It's the amount of time it takes for a universe, an entire universe, to be born, to flourish, to go through a very gradual destruction period, and then to be annihilated. That's one kalpa. And he did zazen for 10 kalpas in a meditation hall, and could neither manifest the truth nor attain Buddhahood. What do these words mean? Manifest the truth nor attain Buddhahood. What 32 marks was he not manifesting? What Buddhahood was he not attaining? And then the monk says, why? Now the master says, your question is a very appropriate one. That's the first barrier in this koan. Why was his question appropriate? Who was he really asking about? Was he interested in some legendary ancient Buddha? Who had suffered for so long, sitting hour after hour, session after session, pain in the knees, distracting thoughts, all sorts of emotions pouring through the body-mind, all the difficulties, and still can't, as he puts it here, manifest the truth or attain Buddhahood. Who was this? It was this monk, of course. And the master said, your question is a very appropriate one. It's very appropriate because it's authentic. It's coming from your core. It's a deep question for you. You need to know this all the way down to the bottom. Now, the beautiful thing here is that the monk didn't just stop here. This is an authentic person who really wants to know. They're not going to be satisfied with this arrow that just hit the skin and fell off. The monk persisted, why did he not attain Buddhahood by doing zazen in the meditation hall? Why didn't he come to enlightenment? Now this is the most difficult part of this koan. Seijo replied, because he didn't. He didn't. This is difficult. He didn't. He struggled. Sat. Mo. What is it? What is the deep truth of that? What is that shining in every moment? What is it showing that is original? Because it's original, it can't be attained. There's no need to attain something that you already have. Because he didn't. Now, when we throw ourselves into our practice with total involvement, deep questioning, what one might call faith, then whether we know it or not, it's already shining. It's emanating. The center is there. this because he didn't. What does this mean now? Exactly as I am, as Yaku Osaki put it, as I am perfect. What a relief to discover that as I am perfectly manifesting true nature. I am perfectly manifesting. I am shining it exactly as I am. Now there's a commentary here. You may know the old Indian. This is an old translation. I'll read the old translation first. You may know the old Indian, but you are not to analyze him. Okay, so you may know this old Indian. It's a symbol for Bodhidharma. There's another translation. The old foreigner may know it, but he can't really grasp it. So you can know it, but you can't grasp it with concepts. You can know it because you are it, and because you are it, you shine it. You are exactly as you are. You are shining that in each moment. This is the moment-by-moment experience of your actual sensations. The fact of your thinking, not the meaning. The feeling of your body. It is shining in each moment, but the moment you try to grasp it, you can't. If you try to figure it out, understand it, make a concept of it, that is going in the opposite direction. It won't bring you there. Why don't I have enlightenment? I have this idea that enlightenment is this. It means I'll be happy all the time, and there'll be rainbows coming out of my head, and I'll have the 32 marks of the Buddha. An ordinary person, this goes on, the commentary, an ordinary person, okay, if he realizes it, is a sage. An ordinary person, if he realizes it, is a sage. This is a person without 32 marks, a person who might feel fear sometimes, might feel happy sometimes, might feel depressed sometimes, might worry about things sometimes. But if he realizes it, and remember this word reality, reality, meaning to present. If the ordinary person gets it, that in each moment, exactly as I am, I present, I am, I shine this amness. And that can only be in the center, because something cannot be outside the center. It wouldn't be known, therefore it wouldn't be. It would be an idea, it would be a concept. So an ordinary person, if he realizes that, is a sage. But a sage, someone who walks around with the 32 marks and holds on to an idea of awakening, so it goes here, a sage, if he understands it, is an ignorant person. So an old foreigner may know it, but he can't really grasp it. He knows it all the way down to the bottom. Can't grasp it. Daitsu Chiso Buddha. Moo. He's not standing apart saying, oh, now I'm enlightened. He's totally immersed in it. He's shining it like the sun is shining. Of course he didn't get it. An ordinary person, if he realizes it, is a sage. A sage, if he understands, is an ignorant person. And then there's a verse. Rather than emancipate the body, emancipate the mind. When the mind is at peace, the body is free. If the body and mind are both set free, why would even gods seek worldly power? So, what does this mean? Rather than emancipate the body, rather than trying to get on the happy train, trying to get all the forms of the world lined up perfectly, so that it matches these 32 marks, or whatever other idea we have for perfection, meaning I won't feel certain things, I will feel other things, I won't act certain ways, I will act other ways. Rather than trying to emancipate the form, the body, the form of yourself, emancipate the mind. Contact, connect with the meaning of thus. Pain in the knee is thus. troubling thoughts are thus. Happiness is thus, sadness is thus. Wind on your skin is thus. This is emancipating what one might call mind, center. If the mind is at peace, then the body's free because you stop fighting your life. The body meaning the facts of your life, your circumstances. You stop doing battle with them, fighting them. You begin to work with them. This is a different kind of freedom. It's the freedom that starts with the way things actually are. Starts with that and holds it in attentiveness and peers into its fact, its thusness. This is freeing the body rather than fighting with the body. You see how we're using the term body here. If body and mind are both set free, if you have a free body, you accord with your karma in each moment, and you perceive the fact of your true nature shining from each and everything. Why would even gods, why would even people with all the power in the world seek that? That is a shadow compared to this kind of freedom. Okay, so I think we've reached the end of our time, and we'll end here.